Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Seth Stevenson and his girlfriend Rebecca were in a rut, tired of the same jobs, friends, hangouts, routines. They joked about chucking it all for a trip around the world. You might have dreamed or joked about the same thing. They did it, but with a catch. No airplanes, none. It was freighters and trains, Siberia and Vladivostok, bicycles in Vietnam, and road trip in the Australian outback. What's it like to leave the job, grab a backpack, and circle the globe as an American these days? They'll tell you. This hour on Point, we're chucking the job and circling the planet close to the ground. You can join the conversation. Do you know the rut? Have you been tempted? Have you done it? Wrangled a real escape and lit out in the world lately? How did it go? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now in the studio, back from all those travels, is Seth Stevenson. He's a contributing writer for Slate, whose work you may have read in the New York Times, Newsweek, Rolling Stone. In August 07, at age 33, he and his girlfriend hit the road and the high seas and the Trans-Siberian. He's written it up in the new book, Grounded, A Down-to-Earth Journey Around the World. Seth Stevenson, welcome to On Point.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me on.
It's great to have you. And with us from Washington, the girlfriend, fellow traveler, global roustabout Rebecca LeGrand. She quit her job as an attorney to circle the globe with Seth. She was 31 when they grabbed their freighter. Rebecca, thank you very much for being here.
Thanks for having us.
It's a great story. You tell it very well. It's not surprising. You've got awards for travel writing, but here you were doing it yourself. It was your second time. You described how earlier you two had sort of lit out in the beat-up Honda for Alaska. And here you were. What year was this? When it was eating at you? When the routine was starting to get you down, Seth?
This was in 2007, and we were living in Washington, D.C., and we both had jobs that kept us busy. They were pretty good jobs, and we had a rotation of friends we hung out with and a rotation of restaurants we went to and bars we'd go to, and it was all fine, but we were sort of taking it for granted. We sort of couldn't see the world around us anymore because it was what we were doing every day. We just felt so encrusted by these routines, and I started getting this real itch to break out of this rut and escape and find an adventure.
You were 30-somethings with an itch, a seven-year itch. Maybe in your case, you've got a great little passage in the book where you describe what that was like. I mean, there are expectations of what people that age do. Could you read a little bit for us from Grounded, Seth?
Sure. Of course, society has a clear prescription for 30-something water-treading couples like Rebecca and me. We're supposed to buy a house and start a family. And indeed, a wave of domesticity had lately crashed over our peer group. Conversations with friends always seemed to gravitate toward real estate and pregnancy, prenatal vitamins, good elementary schools. These struck us as terrific notions to keep in mind for somewhere down the road, but our immediate impulses pushed the other way. We felt no urge to march forward within the socially sanctioned rut, its high walls guiding us smoothly toward parenthood, a mortgage, and on and on. We wanted to scramble out the top of the rut, dust ourselves off, look down from above with relieved smiles, and skip merrily away. Around this time, there appeared a familiar spark of mischief in Rebecca's eyes, and the dares began. "Let's quit our jobs and just hop on a cargo freighter," we joked to each other. These jokes became more frequent, less jokey. Soon enough, we realized we weren't joking at all.
And it wasn't long before they were on a freighter, Seth Stevenson and Rebecca LeGrand. He's written it up in the book Grounded. Rebecca, are you the devil's advocate in this relationship? Are you the one that really puts this tick in and mixes it up, or is it Seth?
You know, I think it's mutual, which is good. I think we both have moments where we start talking a big game about adventure, and occasionally we both start talking about it at the same time, and that's what happened. The next thing you know, we're off in the middle of the Atlantic. So.
And what about the real estate and the pregnancy and the expectations and all the rest of that? What gave you the guts to just go and do it? Are you guys trust fund babies or something?
No, you know, we live pretty cheaply, I think, and we'd saved up some money, and parts of this trip were expensive, but other parts we didn't do we weren't staying in luxury hotels or anything. This is a doable trip for people who manage to save up a little money.
And how much? Do you have to have like a big, you know, rolled, do you have to have bank to do this? Or with your backpack and your freighters, can you do it for, what do you think it takes to backpack as you essentially did around the world?
on land, you can do it as cheaply as you want to do it. I mean, you can stay in hostels. You can take very cheap trains that people who live in those countries take. It's not – you can do this on a shoestring if you want to on land. I would say the problem where it's going to hit your wallet no matter what is moving long distances across water. There's no cheap way to do that.
And even on the freighter these days.
Even on a freighter. And the reason is there's no market for it. Not enough people do it. And so there are no competing services, chopping their prices to try to get you to take their ocean liner. You can either take the Queen Mary 2 or you can take a container ship, and that's about it. Or you can hire your own private, even fancier yacht. And taking a container ship, I would compare it to, it's about buying a business class airplane ticket across the same distance.
Whoa, so that's not peanuts. So, Rebecca, if I had the two of you, you were broke, and I was going to hand you a chunk of change to make it around the world, how much would have to be in that chunk? 5,000, 10,000, 15, 20? I mean, you were on the road for almost 6 months.
Yeah, that's a good question. And we never added it up specifically, including the container ships. It might be more like 10,000. But I point out, we were lucky. We were renters. So we're forgoing a 6 months of rent at home.
That's true.
I actually don't think that I spent more over that 6 months than I would have spent had I been, sitting at home watching TV for 6 months. So, I think it actually ends up costing less than people think.
Just cutting out cable TV and HBO alone,
right. You
save so much.
Hey, you're halfway to Paris already. What was it like when you got out there? Were you really leaving America and Americans behind? Did you find a lot on the road, on the seas? I mean, are Americans out there traveling the world these days, or are they hunkered down at home because they're terrorists, we've got wars, et cetera? What do you think, Seth?
Well, as you know, Americans, as a country, we tend not to travel quite as much as other countries. If you look at percentages of passport ownership, they're pretty low here. And part of that is, America's a huge place with a lot of different things to see, two oceans and all sorts of different kinds of terrain. And so it's great. People want to see this country first. We didn't run into a ton of Americans abroad, especially the further away we got from the U.S., but they're out there. I always tell people, I think the ugly American stereotype is totally off base. The Americans that I meet abroad tend to be pretty polite. They tend to not be super loud. And I think, we're actually pretty good travelers. Maybe not those of us going down to Cabo San Lucas for spring break. But the ones you discover, say,
fun.
In Southeast Asia or in Russia, I tend to get along with great.
We'll talk about that, who you met and what it was on the road. Rebecca, spin the globe for us for a second. Just give us the broad sense of how you made it around the planet. You actually set off in a freighter from Philadelphia. We'll go to the detail of that. But you're like from the northeast of the U.S. to where to get back?
Yeah, so we left by subway directly from my office at work, actually, which was kind of fun.
That must have felt great.
It did kind of feel good to really have everything on your back and take the elevator down and out the door and know that you are on your way to somewhere very different.
And no keys in your pocket, Seth writes. No car keys, no apartment keys, done with that.
Kept patting on it, thinking they were missing.
Not even a big backpack, just a little one. And then just give us the broad strokes. We'll get into it, but how'd you go around?
So we took a train to Philadelphia, and just outside Philadelphia, there's a small container port where we took a container to Antwerp, Belgium. And from Antwerp, we took trains to Rostock.
Germany, then up across the Baltic to Finland, Helsinki.
Correct. And then from there, cut back to Tallinn, Estonia, on a quick little ferry, trains to Moscow, it's sort of an overnight train from Tallinn, Estonia to Moscow. Then we took the Trans-Siberian all the way to Vladivostok. And then, Seth, you want to kick in? You're good.
Yeah,
you're better at the
good.
Details.
From Vladivostok on the Russian Pacific coast, we took a ferry over to the west coast of Japan. Mm-hmm. Then we took bullet trains, Shinkansen, through Japan down to Kobe. And then we took a ferry back to the Chinese coast and then into Beijing. And then trains down to Vietnam, cycled bicycles and buses and trains through Vietnam, buses to Cambodia, hired car to Bangkok, buses to Singapore, cruise ship to Australia, took a road trip across the outback.
Pretty rugged road trip.
Extremely,
there.
Possibly the best road trip in the world. Yes, it was also a fast-paced madcap road trip.
Yep.
And then container ship to New Zealand, cruise ship to Los Angeles, and then Amtrak from Los Angeles back to D.C.
Now, with all that, why no airplanes? And I know it's in part because, Rebecca, you hate flying. Still, all the way around the world with no plane, why?
Why? Well, first of all, I think it's perfectly valid to have a terror of flying, which Rebecca does, and which I sort of caught from
Fine.
Her. It's kind of contagious.
Okay.
But beyond that, you know, it's a terrible experience, even if you're not afraid of it. You know, from the moment you arrive in that security line and take off your belt and your shoes, and then you get on the plane with the recycled air and the cramped seats. But more than that, just spiritually, it's not really traveling. When you take a plane somewhere, you teleport from point A to point B, and that part of your journey is nothing. You never think of it again unless you're complaining about the turbulence or about the kid who's screaming in the row behind you. It's not traveling to me. It's not an experience in the way that when you take a train or you take a ship, you see things at ground level. You have contemplative moments. You're able to let your brainwave sort of stretch out across the territory you're moving through. And it's just much more thoughtful. And for me, flying is it's just hitting fast forward on your trip, and it's just ignoring a part of your journey.
In a Concorde jet, you could have done it in what, 80 hours or something? I'm not sure what the number is.
My first boss, Michael Kinsley, actually did around the world in 80 hours. It sounded terrible. He flew to Nepal, got out for an hour, got back on the plane, kept going.
Sounds pretty bad. Out of your 5 or 6 months on the road, how many days are you actually moving, and how much are like waiting for a train in a station or looking around, enjoying some particular place? Is it half the time that there's actually, you know, land or sea moving under you?
That's a good question. I'd have to sort of look at a calendar and figure that out. Obviously, when we're at sea, we're always moving because those ships don't just stop and anchor when they're going across an ocean. They're moving at, you know, a container ship moves at 20 miles an hour across that ocean and just keeps going and going and going night and day. When we were on land, we would definitely stop in some cities and spend a few days here and there. We spent 10 days in Beijing, for instance. And when we had time to stop at places we wanted to look around on the ground.
Michael Kinsley, founding editor of Slate, talks about Seth's book, Grounded. He says, this irresponsible book is a dagger pointed at the heart of the American economy at the peak of their productive years. Seth Stevenson and his girlfriend Rebecca quit their jobs, abandoned all their worldly possessions, and headed off around the world. My God, what if everybody did that? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about chucking it all and traveling around the world with a couple who did just that and did it all the way around with no flights, no airplanes. Seth Stevenson and Rebecca LeGrand are with us. They spent, 5 or 6 months traveling around the world. Seth's written it up in his new book, Grounded, A Down-to-Earth Journey Around the World. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. And we've got this from the website. Corey says, one of my regrets will always be not doing something like this when I was younger. I'm now middle-aged with children and a mortgage. I'm lucky if I might see Europe one day out the window of a tour bus. I can't encourage young people enough to do something like this while they can. And here's Daphne from Facebook who says, we are preparing to do it right now with our 4-year-old son. Ooh, good luck, gang. You go, Daphne. Let's go to Andrew in Plattsburgh, New York. Andrew, you're on the air with Seth and Rebecca.
Hi. I had a wonderful encounter thanks to a snowstorm this past January. We were snowed in Burlington after the first night celebration, so we had to stay overnight. Anyways, getting on the Interstate 89 out of Burlington, there was a hitchhiker with a small sign, World Tour. So I quickly jammed on the brakes, cleaned off my front seat.
Yeah.
And in jumps this small fellow who turns out to be French, and I speak French, and he was from Paris, doing exactly what his sign said, a world tour on $5 a day, approximately.
Wow. And had he just come from the France to the U.S., or was he going the other way around, nearly home?
He was 2 years into a 5-year trip.
That's a life.
Anyways, so we had snow, it was freezing, the defroster in my piece of junk car wasn't working,
yeah.
But we had to stop partway and defrost the front windshield with a blade from a lawnmower, and I made a video of this, and when we stopped at his destination, which was the next interstate exit in Plattsburgh, I had him open up his travel book, and I made a video and posted it on YouTube under Corvair Wild, so one could look at his trip. He'd been through Zimbabwe, Lebanon, and he says it was the most wonderful thing. He was sleeping on any open space. He spoke on the radio just after I dropped him off,
wow,
and I wish once
great.
I retire, if I live long enough, that I'll be able to duplicate what he has done in his youth. Five years.
It's a great story, Andrew. It's just great. Reminds us of what's possible, including cleaning snow off the windshield with a lawnmower blade. Careful with that. But thank you very much for your call. I mean, Seth and Rebecca, did you find a big population out there like this? Did you run into the equivalent of our Frenchmen on a 5-year trek?
Well, it's funny. I wonder if we saw the same guy. We took this ferry from Vladivostok on the Pacific coast of Russia to Japan, and there was a French guy on there. So this ferry, basically, there were two types of passengers. passengers. The main type of passenger, which about 95% of the people, were Russian used car salesmen going across to Japan to buy used cars, bring them back, and resell them in Russia, even though the steering wheels were on the wrong side of the car.
Yeah, no problem.
The other 5% of the tiny portion of the travelership were people doing bizarre ground journeys, surface journeys, because this is the only other reason you would be taking a 36-hour ferry from the Russian coast to Japan instead of taking a cheap, very quick flight. And we did have a French guy aboard who was doing a nutty surface journey. I wonder if it was the same guy. And we found a few people along the way who were doing that. Mostly you encounter people who are on two-week vacations or maybe three-week vacations, or you'll see a university student on a gap year sometime. We didn't encounter, I would say, too many other people around our age, you know, doing grand voyages.
To stick with that little ferry ride for a moment, that as you describe it, Seth, was a scary moment where your Russian and Serbian and other compatriots took a quite keen interest in Rebecca, including two Serbs who had motorcycled from Belgrade to Vladivostok. Do I recall correctly?
Yeah, well, the Serbs weren't the problem, and we should get Rebecca's perception of this also. But
well,
I
want to hear that.
I'll give you my perception. My perception was, these Russian used car salesmen, you know, burly guys all in leather jackets, get on this 36-hour ferry to go buy some used cars, hit the bar immediately, start pounding vodka. They're pounding vodka the entire time.
So what's the problem?
Take
here?
A very keen interest in Rebecca, who is one of not many women on this ship, and very attractive, if I might say, also. And these guys start edging closer to Rebecca, sort of edging me out of the way.
Buying Rebecca a few drinks.
Yeah, and I was starting to have visions of myself being dangled by my ankles over a ferry railing and dropped into the inky Pacific.
Ciao.
Yeah, but what we should hear, I mean, Rebecca no doubt has a different take.
Your husband was ready to, like, make fists and fight here, Rebecca. Were you having fun, or what was going on?
You're overreacting. No, I think as I showed the next morning, Seth may have been right that I had had a little too much to drink, since I'm not usually seasick and somehow was day.
Yeah.
But it was actually a lot of fun. I think it probably was time to go to sleep, and we went to sleep. But as I recall it, I was, you know, regaling everyone with American politics information was my main recollection of that, and trying to convince the Russian guys on the ship about sort of the relative wonders of American
I see. So it was a poli-sci seminar in your memory, but with Seth, it was a straw dog's nightmare.
Yeah, well, I think that's probably true that she was giving an incredibly smart, sharp, insightful talk about American politics, but I think she could have been talking about anything, and these guys would have been laughing
along. And the chairs would inch closer.
Yes.
Hey, let's get into some of the detail here. The freighter on the way first just out of Philly, you're going to Antwerp. What's that like to be on a container ship? Those are gigantic. I mean, are you just lost on that big thing?
It's fantastic. You don't get lost as long as you stay above deck. I think if you went down into the bowels, you might get lost in some engine rooms or something. But it's great. You get to hang out in the navigational bridge with the officers, and they show you how you drive a container ship and how you chart a course. We got a tour of the engine room, which is this. It's just like your car engine. If your car engine was the size of a ranch house,
yes, that Humongous was meant for.
Yeah, and you go out on the forecastle, which is the very front of the ship, and you can't hear the engine from there, and it's incredibly quiet. You just hear the hull slapping through the waves, and you look for dolphins and humpback whales, and you wonder what's in those containers, and you feel like part of the global economy. I've been recommending it to everybody. I think container ships are a fantastic way to travel.
The ferry, one of your ferries up toward, Tallinn, not so great.
Yes, this is an Estonian ferry that was taking us from Rostock, Germany, on the coast of the Baltic Sea, across to Helsinki. And we bought these seats. It's another 36-hour ferry. We were going to have to be two nights on it. And we bought these seats, and we thought we were going to get nice, wide reclining, you know, first-class airplane-style seats, looking out a window at the ocean from our ferry. Mm-hmm. It turned out they crushed us all down into this tiny, windowless room deep down in the bowels of the hold of the ferry. You know, people cramped together.
Sounds like a refugee boat.
Oh, it's just horrific odors. Everyone's shoes are off, and they haven't showered, and their people are snoring at just atomic levels. And that was one of the low points of the trip, just being in that room, trying to sleep in that room.
Rebecca, what about the Trans-Siberian Railroad? Everybody talks about taking it. Then it's very long. Even Seth writes about the interminable march of the Trans-Siberian. At one point, I think in Moscow or somewhere, you guys talk about going Russian on the train. What did that mean?
There is definitely a style of dress on the Russian trains that I think I was tempted to emulate. It involved a lot of tank tops and
flesh.
I would say mesh tank tops.
Even more flesh.
and I think boxer shorts a lot of the time.
I don't know what to think of that.
And I think we did definitely start to head that direction. There's no showers on the train. So, mm-hmm. you know, I think perhaps the easiest way for people to conceptualize it is just pretend you go to sleep on the first day and you're not really getting out of bed until you get there 7 days later.
And do you recommend it, or is it a marathon you wouldn't recommend?
It's absolutely worth doing. And you don't have to do it as a marathon. You can, and we did get off and stop mm-hmm. along the way, and we could have even stopped more. I think that's a terrific journey. You can do it from Moscow to Beijing is another route that can be done that I think would be – I'd love to do that as well. I think that's got to be one of the great train journeys in the world. It's actually perfectly comfortable, very doable. We did it as independent travelers, so just buying the tickets ourselves as we went, mm-hmm. which involves a little bit of – a little bit of trial and error, but absolutely worked out for us. And I mean, the scenery is amazing. I think I'm a little more positive on Russia as a whole, actually, and would love to go back. But the scenery is amazing. The train journey itself is really interesting. You meet some fascinating people. You get to try random foods purchased at these different stations and have no idea what they are until you get back on the train, which is...
And they'll travel with you. We got travelers lined up on the platform here. Vinny in Boston, you're on the air, Vinny.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
A couple years ago, I took a trip to Alaska on a whim with a friend of mine who has done extensive bike tours. And we went to Alaska for 5 weeks, and we rode around over 1,000 miles on our bikes. We encountered grizzly bear and a bunch of other wildlife, and it was unbelievable. Although we didn't take a shower the entire time, it was, I'll never forget it. I would love to do another travel like that at some point.
Maybe. How's it compare to staying home and working, Vinny? How's it compare?
Oh, you can't compare. I met a guy in Fairbanks who, he was Swiss, and said that he goes and works about 1 year out of four and travels for the rest of them.
You said
and,
you did it on the spur of the moment, Vinny. How do you do that? What about working? What about income, money, cash?
Well, I just I had a little bit of money saved up, and I just did it. I said, whatever. I bought a ticket in the middle of the night and said, I'm gone. It's 10 days later, I was on the plane out there. Wow. Headed towards Anchorage.
That is pretty great. Grizzlies and all the rest. Vinny, thanks for that. Let's get more. So many stories here. Doriana from Jamestown, Rhode Island. Doriana, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
How are you?
Good.
My story is sort of backwards from the people you have, the panel you have today. I met my husband some years ago when I decided I was tired of kind of my dead-end job and took my savings and went and traveled to Asia, mm-hmm. starting in Bangkok. And eventually, when I got to Nepal, I met my future husband, or my present husband, I should
mm-hmm.
say.
Mm-hmm.
And he was in the same position where he was at a kind of a dead-end factory job, and he took all his savings and went to Nepal. And we met, and it was the last 11 days of my journey. So when I came back, we knew that either he was going to come to the States or I would go to Italy, where he was from. I'm also Italian descent.
Yeah, yeah.
A coincidence. And so it turned out that I went to Italy. We traveled some more. We love traveling. And by the way, it can be extremely cheap. The expense really is in a flight, which it was for me going to Asia.
Unless you don't fly like Seth and Rebecca. And what about,
right.
you know, but it still costs money. Do you look back on it, Doriana, and think, oh, we should have bought a mortgage. We should have got a house.
No, not at all, because it cost us, we went back to India for 6 months after that. And the whole trip, including food and sleeping, cost us $750, not including the flight. That was the expense again. But $750 in 6 months of travel, he and I. Well, we ended up coming back to the States, getting married, starting a business, having twins, loving traveling still. We take our twins. We own a tiny artisan bakery that we work together.
Yeah.
And every year we close for 2 months and we travel. We go with our children. We take them out of school and we just travel and we love it.
Wow, a bag full of memories, a husband, twins, and a bakery and 2 months travel every year. Everybody's going to envy you, Doriana. Thank you very much for your call. Let's get one more from Tim in Jeffersonville, Vermont. Tim, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Well, what do you know?
Oh, I just wanted to make a couple comments. First of all, applaud these two for their style of
mm-hmm.
traveling.
Yeah.
I appreciate that. And what I've been doing, Tom, is I have a small construction business, and I work through the summer and spring and the fall, and every winter I take 4 to 6 months off and travel overseas. I've been doing that for 7 years now. And what I've found in my travels that's really made an impression upon me is the style in which you travel. We've been talking a lot about how much it costs and so on and so forth, and I found that you can really do things really, really cheaply if you're willing to open your hearts and your mind to the local people. You'll find that they're really hospitable, especially in places like Western Africa, or I was down in Colombia this past winter for 6 months, and we were able to travel for $500-$600 a month for my wife and I both.
That's pretty good.
You really can do things very cheaply, I think, if you're able to open your mind and have a spirit of adventure. Obviously, you want to be safe, but I think it's just really important to stress the difference between tourism and traveling and the impact that it has on the local people. If you take, for example, a small town in Colombia and you go there as an American, the people will receive you quite differently than they will in a town like Cartagena, where there's cruise ships coming through and people with their cameras, and I think that makes a big difference on our impact globally.
Tim, it's a great point, and I love your story. You remind me of my great old friend Jim Toby, who used to do construction work and more up in Vermont every winter, and every summer, and head to New Zealand every winter. What a great life it is, Seth. This difference between tourism and travel—I mean, that's something you are right in the middle of. And anybody who knows the difference feels it pretty acutely. It's a very different experience when you've got that time that you had.
Sure, there's just that time to adjust. I mean, when you fly somewhere far away and land and you have a week there, you spend the first couple of days, I think there's this shock to your system where you haven't really spiritually left home yet. You're still seeing the place through the eyes of where you left from, and you know, you might have some jet lag. You may have some adjustments with you may catch a bug or something if you're going somewhere far away. Mm-hmm. And then by the time, you know, it's just as you're starting to actually feel like you're in the place with your feet solidly on the ground and feeling like you're really there, that's when you have to fly back. It's a lot different when you have time to spread out and figure, you know, go where you're going to go next and wake up not knowing what you're going to do because you don't have an itinerary every day, and just be in a place, just have time to be there rather than be sightseeing all the time. And, you know, you meet when you travel around. When we did this trip, we met people on all sorts of different kinds of schedules like that. You meet the people who are only there for 1 week, and you can sort of feel the way that they aren't letting themselves fully be in the place. Mm-hmm. They're still sort of talking about work and still thinking about, you know, being back at their desk in 4 days. And then you meet the people who are out like us for, you know, a few months or maybe 6 months and much more relaxed, but still, you know, tethered to reality to some extent. Still, there's a gossamer string holding us.
Oh, yeah.
And then you meet the sort of the permanent nomads.
Perpetual vagabond.
The people who have been on the road for 15 years and they're never going back. And you know, they're working in a dive shop for 2 months and then they're going
tempted?
Somewhere else. You know, sure. There are moments when I was tempted and I thought and motion kind of becomes its own drug and you you get addicted to that motion and you think, why don't we just keep moving around and seeing new things? And why would I ever want to go back and just live in one place and hang out with the same people and do the same job? But, you know, I think for me, I understand why some people could make that choice. For me, I couldn't quite go there. I like checking out for 6 months at a time, but I don't think I want to check out for 15 years.
Rebecca, were you on the same page with Seth there, or did one of you sort of lean toward the never-ending journey?
I think I occasionally espouse the idea of the never-ending journey. I think Seth is a good reality check on that. In reality, that's a very different choice, and maybe not a healthy choice. Maybe that is where, you know, a line between what's a adventure that we should all take and maybe being a little too irresponsible kicks in. But yes, I get sorely tempted sometimes to say, you know, when we were in Langkawi, which is this gorgeous island off the coast of Malawi, coast of Malaysia,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
Just to say, well, you know, let's just work here for 2 months
That's
and
right.
then pop to the next island out and keep it going. And I actually think Seth does often take the sane and sensible role of, yeah, no, this is a journey, but a journey that needs to eventually end. So I think that both positions need to be out there.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about chucking it all and traveling around the world with a couple who did just that, 30-somethings. They did it all the way around with no flights, no airplanes. Seth Stevenson and Rebecca LeGrand took off and did it. Seth has written it up in his new book, Grounded, A Down-to-Earth Journey around the world. There's an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. And it's a great story, great humor throughout. All trains and freighters and, Seth, in Vietnam, bicycles.
Bicycles, which is a fantastic way to see a country if you ever get a chance to do that. Just the perfect pace to, you don't miss a thing. You hear everything because you're not making any noise except the clicks of your chain. You can have a nice, gentle conversation with the person pedaling along next to you. If you see something you're interested in, you just stop and put your bike down on the ground, take a look, and then get back on your bike and keep pedaling. I recommend that as a wonderful way to see a country.
How many miles of Vietnam on bicycle? That's a long, long country.
Well, we didn't bicycle the whole thing. Our fitness level was not going to quite make us capable of doing that. But we were with a group where we would cycle, you know, some long stretch, maybe I think at most 50 or 60 miles in a day. And then we had a support truck that would take us to our next stretch that we would do. And we took a train at one point. So it's not as though we were cycling the entire length of Vietnam, but we were getting in very long stretches.
There was one point, Rebecca, if I read correctly, that you actually didn't make, that Seth left you standing on the pier in Singapore where he's racing for a cruise ship or a cargo ship down to Indonesia. Why did he leave you there, Rebecca?
I guess I just was talking too. No, it was
too
it
much
was
trouble.
Too much trouble. I swear, it would have served me right, frankly, probably. But no, it was incredibly lucky that Seth got on this ship. But yes, it is true. I did not actually make it all the way around the world without flying. I flew one leg from Singapore to Bali because Seth had a freighter ship lined up to try and get from Singapore to Australia, which is sort of a particularly tricky little leg to do without flying. Mm-hmm. There's just no really great way to do it. Freighter gets canceled. Seth is sitting despondent in Singapore. We're trying to figure out how we're going to make this work. We saw a cruise ship sitting in the dock. And Seth, do you want to? I think both of us can explain this. Well, but yeah, okay. Give your view of it. Yeah,
Rebecca spotted this cruise ship. I'd given up all hope, and I thought there's no
head
way
in this
cruise ship could be going anywhere. Yep. It could be headed for Dubai. Who knows? And but it turned out it was headed to Australia, and I made a series of desperate phone calls to their booking agency in England, and had to sort of talk my way aboard. And Rebecca, we were at the pier. Rebecca ran back to our hotel in Singapore to go get our luggage.
Yeah, luggage. This is too little. Backpacks.
Well, two backpacks.
Everything we own in them.
Right.
Yeah, and the hopes that we're actually going to get on this ship. And while she's off doing that, the guy on the ship, the guy in charge of, I can't remember his title, but he comes running out in his white cruise ship outfit with the epaulettes.
Bursar, maybe, or whatever.
Yeah, there you go. And he's, Mr. Stevenson, Bursar. follow me. Yeah. We literally sprint down the gangplank in Singapore Harbor onto this cruise ship. They pull up the gangplank as I'm taking the last step.
Hi, Rebecca.
The horn is sounding on the ferry, and we pull out, and I all I have is the clothes on my back. No, I don't have my backpack, and so I had made a quick call to Rebecca on the bursar's cell phone to tell her, meet me in Bali in 3 days.
Wow. And there you are out in the world. You know, we've got to get into Australia on that road trip. We've got some really kind of tear-jerking notes. Here's one from the website. This is from Natalie. She says, I graduated college last year. I've been dying to do this. However, I have student loans in addition to other grown-up responsibilities. I'm young and feel like this is the time to do a trip like this, but don't know how to make it work without defaulting on my loans. What are young people supposed to do in today's economy when we have so much pressure to get jobs right out of college and pay off our loans? Is the idea of the young American traveler at risk? How do you make this work? And if I may, here's something like an answer from another poster, David. He says, my wife and I got married in our early 30s, saved and planned for 2 years, quit our advertising jobs amidst cries of what about your careers, and went backpacking around the world for 14 months. It was a life-changing experience. Cost us roughly $35,000, most of the time on the cheap. Stayed in 4-star hotels from time to time. Haven't traveled much since. It's been all mortgage, kids' education, nose to the grindstone. No regrets, though. There it is. Let's go to Rick in Saxons River, Vermont. Rick, what's your story?
I want to encourage people to not think it's just a young person's thing. We took our two children when they were age 8 and 11 and mm-hmm. took 9 months and traveled around the world with them. And I'm a big proponent of quantity time with your kids over quality time. To be that close
stretch
to kids
it out,
nine
yeah.
months. Now that they're teenagers, it's this fundamentally different relationship I have with my kids than most people have.
What about school for them? 9 months, how'd that work?
You can there's homeschooling. There's a way in Vermont to have a really simple process to apply to the state to be a homeschooler, and you send a curriculum in, and you have to document at the end of the year their learning.
And looking back, any regrets or the opposite?
Oh, no, it's the greatest thing we ever did as a family, and we continue to travel and do things together, and the four of us are incredibly close because of all that time together.
I feel the jealousy out there, but it sounds great, Rick, and thank you very much for your call. Sam in Boston, you're on the air, Sam.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Good.
I actually dropped out of a prestigious upstate New York small liberal arts college to travel around the world. I went from Boston to Morocco, backpacked up across North Africa to Europe, hopped a flight down to Australia, drove around Australia, made some great friends, came back to Boston with them, and then we drove to L.A.
That's a journey. And and did you get back in school, or did you go off on a whole new tangent, different path?
I did. It took another year and a half for me. I'm 24, and I actually just graduated in January. But this was one of the defining characteristics of my life, I think. It definitely changes your perspective when you know, all my friends were in school, they were trying to be lawyers or doctors, and I didn't know what I wanted to do, and it was really hard to just sit there and watch as everyone seemed to go forward with their life, and I felt in a way I was going backwards. And I think that this gave me direction. It's just given me a new perspective.
Country might be better off if more people did it and learned what they learned out there on the road. Sam, thanks for that call. One more right here. Scott in Barrie, Vermont. Scott, you're on the air.
Hi. My wife and I got married when we were about 29. I quit my job. She had just graduated from 2 years of school and put an icebox in a little Mazda GLC two-door and traveled around the country for a year and a day.
Wow.
We stayed at national parks and camped and hiked. And then we went to cities and stayed with friends and worked, saved some money. We left with
$1,400. $1,400 in 9 months and memories that last forever.
A year and a day.
A year and a day. I love it. Scott, thanks very much for that. Wherever you're doing it, it sounds like it's working. Seth, I wish you'd read us a little more. Just get us into your trip. There's a moment in Cambodia, I think, in Phnom Penh, where you're talking about how you've kind of gotten used to some things, but some things you don't get entirely used to.
We've traveled enough now that I'm growing inured to the exotic and shocking, the feral animals on the loose, the naked beggar children filling the sidewalks, the millions of moto rickshaws careening around the streets. None of it phases me anymore. The fact is, though, Cambodia is the least developed country we're likely to visit on this trip. It's a bit of a wild frontier, and as such, tends to attract a slightly different flavor of Western tourist. My amateur research reveals that the Western crowd here comprises two main categories. First, the backpackers. These budget travelers come in search of crazy cheap accommodations, a taste of adventure, and, perhaps above all, marijuana. Strolling around the backpacker district in Phnom Penh, I'm approached at least three separate times by Cambodian dealers whispering, "Good smokes. I have good smokes." There's a strange economy in the backpacker district. Rooms are $2 for the night. Pot is essentially free, as it seems there's always someone passing around a joint. But a dog-eared 15-year-old English-language Tom Clancy paperback will run you a whopping $5. I suppose it's just supply and demand. The cheapest backpacker hostels are clustered on the banks of a swollen lake. We wander into the grounds of a $2-per-night guest house and find them completely flooded. A small fish jumps out of the foot-deep murk, splashes back down, and disappears. A kid returning to his room has trouble opening his door because of the lake water stacked up against it. When he finally succeeds, he sends a thick, rippling wave coursing across the courtyard. On a veranda above, two blazed-out kids watch a Hollywood movie on DVD, smoking yet another bowl. "Maybe they should call this place the Chilling Fields," I say to Rebecca. "You're going to hell," she says, taking my hand and leading me back toward civilization. The gin and tonic I later order at the Raffles Hotel, in an attempt to wash all tang of backpacker from my system, costs enough to house one of those stoned rangers in a Fleabag hostel for a full 2 weeks.
And there's one of two classes in the other, weirdly, sadly, in Phnom Penh, of traveler pedophiles.
Oh,
sex great. why wash away the tang of backpackers? Is it so repugnant?
Well, you know,
you were backpackers, for heaven's sakes.
We were backpackers. We liked. I at least like to think of myself as a slightly classier grade of backpacker, I guess, rather than you know not the backpacker who's got a didgeridoo dragging from the back of his backpack.
Okay,
and
okay.
You know, I don't know.
That would be me, I think.
Rebecca, how did you feel toward the backpacker? She may have her own feelings.
Yeah,
about
Rebecca.
Them.
I've definitely been, you know, and I do think we're a little older and could afford to occasionally do luxuries that weren't really that expensive, like stay at a nice hotel. So yeah, we are a little bit not in the mix with backpackers as much, but I am still a backpacker, I think, fundamentally. However, this Cambodian, there are different backpacker neighborhoods in the world, mm-hmm. and the Cambodian yep. backpacker ghetto was really the bleakest I may have ever seen. It was just because the kids looked like they were not moving, not really looking around the country, not really traveling. They just sort of gotten stuck in these flooded houses watching Simpsons reruns all day. It was not a high moment
on the
in backpacker.
Not really discovering the wonders of Cambodia.
Yeah, wow.
That is definitely not true of all backpackers, but this was a not my favorite little backpacker district. If you're ever in Phnom Penh,
take us to another scene. That road trip in Australia. Talk about austere, kind of a brutal scene. Just give us a picture, if you would, Seth, of what that's like. You hit the road in a car that cost almost nothing. I don't know how that happens in Australia. That's not exactly Cambodia. And the terrain is, talk about empty.
Sure. Well, we thought we scored this incredible deal where we got a relocation rental car for $4 total. We just had to bring it from Darwin on the northern coast of Australia to Sydney.
Is that all?
Turns out that's essentially like driving from, you know, Montana to Miami in
yep.
4 days. And we were a slave labor. It was a madcap dash across the outback. But it is an amazing place to drive through, and just so barren and so such a doomland, and you know, you become aware that every animal you encounter could kill you in a matter of seconds if
such
it wanted
as
to.
Kangaroos, what lethal kangaroos? What?
Well, they are kind of lethal because they take you
to
down
our
with them.
Camry.
Yeah, well, yeah. So kangaroos have a death wish. In my experience, we would see them. They hop alongside the road. In
oh,
troops.
Never mind moose or deer. You've got the
yeah. They are sort
the
of
road.
The deer of Australia, and they'll when they see your car coming, they'll hop right in front of it. They just time it perfectly and hop right in front of it. And now we notice that all the other cars on these, you know, empty highways in the middle of the outback had gigantic grills on the front to deflect the kangaroo limbs back on when, you know, smash into one. We just had this little, you know, family sedan with no grill on the front. We were terrified we were going to get, you know, a kangaroo through our windshield. And obviously you can't go in the water, you know, when you're in Darwin on the northern coast, because there's box jellies and saltwater crocodiles. But we would pull into these roadhouses in the middle of nowhere in the heart of the outback. And we'd find these nice people. We were drinking with these jackaroos, which are Australian cowboys.
Yeah.
They were telling us stories about herding up the cattle on motorbikes and dragging them to the ground and shooting kangaroos for meat.
Were they pulling their chairs up closely around Rebecca?
No, you know what? These guys. I don't know what it was, but I'm sure they were equally attracted to Rebecca, of course. But perhaps they just had a different way of showing it.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Before long, you were home, and I wish you'd read a little bit for us about, here you are in Australia, there's another ship, you're in Auckland, New Zealand, there's a long sail across the Pacific and then train across the U.S., and pretty soon you're back in Washington, you've
back
got
in Washington,
a new apartment, you're set up again, mm-hmm. the great, great, great road trip around the world in, not 80 days, but
about a little under 6 months.
6 months is over, and you're back. Let's hear that.
Our first night in our empty new place, we sleep on an air mattress we bought for $50 at a local discount store. Lying awake, I catalog my regrets. We never rode on elephants or behind a team of sled dogs. We never sailed on a yacht. We've so much more traveling left to do. But in the morning, it hits me full force. For the first time in forever, there's nowhere to go next. I haven't the energy or resources to continue this adventure. I'll sleep in the same room again tonight, and the night after that, and the night after that. The readjustment is brutal. The little victories and losses of day-to-day existence seem ridiculous. When we get our furniture and clothes back from the storage company, I'm almost physically repulsed by the sight of them. It feels like someone else's possessions. Why on earth did we ever buy all these things, and worse, take the trouble to preserve them while we were away? Everything I need, I now know for sure, I can fit into a backpack. But of course, the fierceness fades. Week by week, I grow softer. Comfort and routine begin to creep back in. We need to make money, so Rebecca finds another law firm job, and I start writing for magazines again. We trade out our air mattress for a real bed and get a flat-screen TV and an internet connection. We go out to the same bars and restaurants that we did before. We're right back in the thick of it, carving new ruts. One day, though, a few years down the line, I know we'll blow it all up again. Perhaps we'll be walking along a beach and we'll see a sailboat out past the breakers. I'll catch a little gleam in Rebecca's eye, and we'll both be thinking, I wonder how far away we can get in one of those.
on a sailboat, a little gleam past the breakers. Wow. Will you do it, Rebecca? Will you blow it all up again?
I am always tempted. And so, Seth, tomorrow maybe? You want to take off?
Sure. Let me check my calendar. It should work for me.
So what do you bring back? What do you learn from all that? Do you come back the same? Do you come back different? Do you just come back richer? And I don't mean in wages.
I think you... it is fun, if nothing else. So you certainly come back and feeling you've learned a lot about all these different places you've never been in, and you suddenly have a very different picture in your head when you're watching the world news and hearing about all these places. Mm-hmm. And you feel, I do think it gives you a sense of, my gut instinct has always been that owning things isn't what gives me pleasure as much as doing things, and this certainly reinforces that. The memories you have and the experiences you have on the road are a lot more important to me than buying a new car or something like that, and it definitely reinforced that. But at the end of the day, I think as Seth gets at there, you come back and you still sort of have questions about, we're not going to become 15-year vagabonds, so you do need to be building a real life too. So the balance between when you can throw it all in and take off, and when you should be sticking it out at home, I think is something we still work through.
Well, you've got my wanderlust cranked up to code red. What's the next target when you light up for the next territory, Seth? What's it going to be? Do you know?
Well, we started experimenting with sailing a little bit, and we really had a great time sailing around on a boat where I was the captain and Rebecca was the first mate. And I think I would love to take longer and longer sailing voyages. That would be that's one thing I'd love to do.
Well, you'd better get some great magazine writing jobs to pack away the bank for that, but we wish you luck with it. This is a wonderful journey and a wonderful telling of it. Seth Stevenson's book is Grounded, a down-to-earth journey around the world. Rebecca, we're really grateful to you for taking the time to be with us today. Thank you so very much. It's nice to meet the woman who's on the ferry to Japan. Your Russian admirers. Thanks for joining us, Rebecca.
Thanks so much for having us.
And Seth, really great to have you. Good luck with your travels. Thanks for being here.
Thanks a lot.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.